for our last session. We're going to talk about something a bit different now. And I understand from Lena you're intrigued rather than repelled by the idea of talking about something that's not just about economics and finance. So that's good. What I'm going to do is talk to you a little bit about a view of the financial crisis from biblical ethics. And it seems to me that as economists, and I count myself as well, we often get taken over by the economics worldview, right? And the economics worldview basically says that people are totally selfish. They seek to maximize at all times. They are rational and forward-looking, etc., etc. I agree that there are different economic paradigms. The behavioral finance that we've just talked about already says, well, all that perfect market stuff may not be quite right. But as you know, I'm a pastor as well as an economist, and so I've got very interested in a theological point of view on some of the issues relating to what are real-world problems. When I was at Bible College up to 2007, I wanted to do a dissertation on, and I did, on poverty. And basically what I did was I looked at poverty from an economics point of view, and you found that, you know, there are some useful things on poverty in the economics. Particularly people like Dasgupta at Cambridge have done a lot of interesting thinking on how labor supply can be influenced by nourishment, so that if people are not nourished properly, their labor supply falls and that gets cumulatively wiped out. And equally, there are people like Jeffrey Sachs who've written very sort of, challenging books about how the world is challenged to address global poverty. But what I found was that when we look at the Bible and theology, that we get a sort of broader picture of poverty, and we get some really good reasons as to why we may do something about poverty, which in a sense economics is unable to produce on its own. So with that as background, I attended a conference not so long ago on the crisis from a theological point of view. We were talking about Christian debt agencies and things like that. And they said, who wants to do a bit more in-depth work on thinking about theology and the financial system and ethics? And I sort of said, yes, I'll do something. I assumed that there would be quite a number of people who wanted to do this. And then I found out that I was the one. And so I took that as a challenge. The body I was working for is actually an umbrella body for my church, which is the Baptists, as well as Methodists, and various big charities in the UK that are Christian, like Tear Fund. And so what I did was I wrote this paper, which is still in draft, but which you can get from the website if you're interested. And let's just go on to see what it does. Oops, oh no. Okay, we've got moving graphics in this one. Right, basically we've got a crisis at the moment which is of unprecedented intensity, but my argument is that from a Christian standpoint, very little had been said. I mean, in fairness, the Pope has said a few things. From a Catholic point of view, we've also had the Archbishop in UK, but not much that's really getting down to the roots of it. But I would argue that if we look at it from a biblical theology point of view, we might be able to say quite a lot of useful things, especially when we look at it alongside economics. And I can't cover the whole lot because it's 46 pages. And there is a section, though, which tries to look at economics in a sense as a modern theology. Because I think economics is, in a sense, a very strong worldview that people are using in government, in all sorts of thinking. And it's one that, whether or not you share entirely my Christian standpoint, I think is one that we shouldn't just accept without criticism. because, as I said earlier, economics is very narrow. It leaves out altruism. It gives no ultimate reason for the value of a human being, I don't think. So what is the study doing? It was trying to look at policy implications for the financial crisis, informed by economic thought, but from a biblical point of view. Ministers, I mean church ministers, not government ministers there, but in a sense, the idea is, on the one hand, to tell people in churches about what's going on, but it's also to challenge the establishment and say, look, don't you think there may be some other things we should be taking into account? So that's why I talk about radical Christian solutions to some of the current difficulties, because and the moment may already be passing when people are really ready to think completely and newly about banking and things. But I think that's very important. So what the whole paper does is it looks at three aspects of the crisis, one of which I'm going to present, is looking at the role and incentives of the bankers. The second one is the plight of households with indebtedness, and the third one is the rising government debt and the responsibility of governments. So basically I look through all of those, and the way I structure it is to firstly present a sort of economics analysis of the problem. So for example, the households, I talk about this diagram here. The economics of indebtedness is to do with what changes in desired consumption relative to desired income and investment we have over the life cycle, and whether people have suddenly become more willing to take on debt in recent years. That's the economics of debt. The theology of debt is to do with the Bible warning people about going into debt, because it in a sense binds the future. It reduces the amount of flexibility you have in your life, and I've heard plenty of people in the UK talking about that. You know, having a mortgage means that you couldn't possibly stop your job and do something else, or you might sometimes not even be able to have a child because you can't afford to pay. That's just an example of the sorts of things we look at in that section. And in terms of public debt, what we're thinking about there on the economic side, of course, is what we've already said. Governments have got banking reform, a bank recapitalization issue. We've got a recession, but we've also got useless fiscal policy before the recession. And to my mind, the theological aspect of that is to say governments should have been more responsible before the recession. In effect, they were hoodwinking the electorate by running too loose a fiscal policy in the upturn. And what that is doing is it's imposing on the fathers, imposing on the children, the sins of the fathers, in the sense that we've messed up the fiscal policy, but our children are going to have to pay the government debt. So those are just illustrations of some of the issues that one can look at. Let me summarize broadly what I get to. What I would argue is that in the financial crisis, we can see some common threads across all three of those areas of action, whereby a variety of actors have acted economically, if you like, to try and maximize their personal utility in the pursuit of self-interest. So the bankers have sought maximum bonuses by taking on high-yielding assets that in the end proved to be very risky. Households have borrowed up to their necks, and governments also have run loose fiscal policies because, in the UK at least, because they thought it would be good to get re-elected, not to raise taxes and to boost government expenditure. And all that's pretty much in line with economic thought, everyone for themselves. But I would argue that there was a flaw in the rationality of each of those approaches, in the sense that people were acting in greed, selfishness, impatience. Those are words that we never use when we're talking about economics, but they were, in a sense, relevant to what behavior was actually occurring. The bankers were pushing too hard, They bankrupted their institutions. Governments are now facing unprecedented fiscal deficits, and they're going to get chucked out of office in the case of the UK. Households, at least in the UK, are regarding themselves as over-indebted and very much concerned about whether they'll keep their houses, especially when unemployment rises and when interest rates rise. So what we have to bear in mind is that those things can be important, and it's argued, the general point is that the outcomes weren't just bad for the actors, but also they overflowed to innocent bystanders in the rest of the economy. The casualties would include, for example, people who lost their jobs because the recession, which you can trace back ultimately to errors in banking, but which did not lead to losses of jobs in banking, but rather losses of jobs in the manufacturing sector or the retail sector, as well as spillovers to emerging market countries that were innocent of participation in the upturn. And what I do is I highlight potential remedies. Again, here's a word we never use in economics, the underlying pattern of idolatry of institutions. What do I mean by that? I mean that what we may do sometimes is we attribute agency to an institution as if it's separate from the people who are part of it. And if you think maybe about the way this country was governed before 1991, you can immediately see the sorts of things we have in mind. But one can think here about banks, you know, the bank did it rather than the people who are working in the bank did it. That the government ought to do something rather than everyone involved has the responsibility to put pressure on the government, etc., etc. So that's an underlying aspect that we have to think about. And what we come to critique as well is the overall aims of economics, which are wealth, consumption, and power, in contrast to what Jesus proclaimed, which is the kingdom of God, which is to do with loving God and loving neighbor. It doesn't have to be inconsistent with prosperity, but it doesn't focus on prosperity in the sort of narrow sense of going in a selfish manner for maximum possible benefits. And so what I'm going to do in the time we've got now is to look a little bit about the section on risk-taking incentives for banks. And, I'll be interested in any one who wants to comment and talk about these things. And this is designed for presentation. Actually, I have presented it at the FSA, to the Christian group at the FSA. So, you know, you're the second lot of regulators who've heard this. And they were quite lively, so feel free to interrupt. This is the economics perspective, so there won't be anything very new now here. But I think it's worth emphasizing that banks are central to the economy, first of all. And these are quite a helpful bunch of factors that banks are involved, functions rather, that banks do. And this is from Merton and Bodie's textbook on banking, the new financial system. So they're involved in clearing and settling. They're involved in pooling funds, which is deposits transformed into loans. They're involved in transferring resources over time, geographic regions, countries and industries, very straightforward. Lending, basically, the stuff we're talking about. They're managing uncertainty and controlling risk. They're providing price information, and they're dealing with incentive problems. For example, moral hazard and adverse selection for their borrowers. That's all very well known and straightforward. What that means, of course, and that's what we've been talking about this morning, is that widespread bank failure is very damaging. In fact, if you trace back to that previous page, you can think of a number of channels whereby the costs of financial instability will manifest themselves, to do with the loss of lending, the pooling of funds, the loss of control over uncertainty, the illiquidity of markets, the price information. So that's those seven ways, six ways, are an alternative way of thinking about costs of crisis as well as everything else. And the point is that the performance of those functions, and again, these are words we don't use much in economics, but people do use them. Performance of these functions requires integrity and prudence on the part of bankers. Now, integrity and prudence immediately are ethical terms. They're to do with behavior, they're to do with character, and traditional banking knows very well that if those things are not carried out, then the banking system will get into difficulty. And I'm going to argue that biblical theology gives us some interesting angles on those aspects, among others. So, what can we say about the crisis? What we've already discussed, really, that there was a dangerous incentive pattern in the combination of the bonus culture that banks had and the safety net that the government provided. So, for example, the bankers were incentivized to take risks. The safety net, on the other hand, was there to protect the banks from the consequences of their risks, to some extent. And that was true especially for the managers. And we had a very egregious example in the UK. Fred Goodwin, who was the head of RBS, when it got into difficulty, he lost his job, but he was given a pension of £700,000 a year by the government. And so if that's not a safety net, I don't know what is. And equally, you know, the employees who bought the CDOs have not necessarily lost their jobs. On the other hand, maybe in the long run, shareholders may benefit, but in the short run, shareholders are not necessarily going to benefit from the safety net. Ultimately, the safety net, if it's done properly, should expropriate equity holders. But even there, it's not at all clear that the shareholders in some of these banks who initially got rescued but have got out of the government's arms are now doing quite well, actually. So there's no direct relationship between responsibility and consequence in the crisis. And the question is, are these individuals directly culpable? In other words, did they deliberately make mistakes that would lead them into crisis, or were they making errors subconsciously? And that's where the disaster myopia comes in, that we've discussed in this lecture course, that there is a tendency for people in banks and elsewhere, I guess, to forget about the problems that may arise from taking risks, what we call disaster myopia. And in that sense, it's a form of irrationality linked to behavioral finance, as we said, not necessarily direct culpability, which would be what we would put in terms of rationality. And we've seen a particular vulnerability of securitized products, of course, and that we've discussed several times. And an important aspect of banking that we've talked about in terms of agency costs is the principal agent problem. That we know that there are numerous principal agent problems in banking. Basically, we have the bank, we have the depositor, and we have the regulator. Equally, we have the relationship between the bank and its employees, who may act in their own interests as well. And as we've discussed, well, we haven't discussed this particularly, in economics there are three ways to control principal agent problems. what we call complete contracts, where you specify people's behavior in every way, people's reputation, and desire to maintain ongoing relationships. And you'll note that all of those are consistent, and everything else I've said is consistent with the idea of selfish individual maximization and rationality, except maybe disaster myopia. But complete contracts, reputation, and ongoing relationships, these are all things that people are only supposed to be motivated to do because it's in their self-interest. And you maintain your reputation because you'll get a better job in the future. You keep the relationships because they're important to you. And the complete contract assumes that if you don't have a complete contract, you're so untrustworthy that you will automatically do something that's not in the interests of the person who is the principal, which, you know, as I say, could be the regulator and the bank in supervision, and could be the bank employing people. It could equally be the equity holder. Okay. This is bank supervision. This is employment contract. This is corporate governance. All of those involve principal-agent problems, yeah? And, you know, I hope you can see immediately that there are underlying ethical questions and underlying issues that are worth thinking about. Prudential regulation is a response, as we know, but it can be subject to disaster myopia as well, in that the regulators may not always be able to detect problems, as was the case with the macroprudential surveillance before the subprime crisis. And what I argue is that the economics of the banking crisis is pretty good at explaining it. I wouldn't have spent all this time talking to you if I didn't think that. But I still think there are things that we aren't fully explained. And one thing is about rationality. We've already said, well, it might be in people's short-term interest, but was it always in their long-term interest to do what they did? And equally, we have in any textbook the banking virtues of prudence, trust, and honesty, that a good banker is someone who should be prudent. They should check carefully what things they're holding, check carefully who they're lending to. They should be trustworthy. You shouldn't have to keep a close eye on them all the time, especially if they're in senior management. They should be honest. You should know that bankers are not going to run off with the money. And of course they don't directly, but still, those are values or virtues that economics doesn't really have room to deal with or motivate, unless we just link them back to this thing and we say, well, it's because they're trying to maintain their reputation, it's because they're trying to maintain their relationships, which are in their interests. And the question is then, well, if people really follow that, then how far do you trust their prudence, trust, and honesty if the only motivation for it is selfish maximization? Would it not be better if people could somehow be motivated by something higher than that? That's a question that I think we're left with. So what about the theological perspective? So I'll talk to you a bit about this. I think the Bible has obviously not got a banking sector in it, although in the parable of the talents, Jesus does say to the guy who dug a hole for his money and hid it, he says, "You stupid," this is the story he's telling. The manager has given, the boss has given three people money and said, go and do something with these, and some people do something very productive, some people do something less productive, the third one hides it in the ground. And the manager says, well, the least you could have done is put it with the bankers. So that's an interesting quote. So there were bankers around, even in biblical times. But I think the Bible can tell us quite a lot about ethics in business all the same. And an interesting place to start is the Genesis story of the fall. You'll be familiar with this, I imagine. Basically, Adam and Eve are in the garden with God, and then they're tempted by the serpent to take the apple, and they decide, because the serpent says, you will be like God, that they will take the apple and defy God, basically, who has otherwise been extremely nice to them. And in a sense, what that is showing us is the importance of what I would call hubris and pride, that we're vulnerable as human beings to being like that, that we will often overlook the risks of what we're doing. We can get corrupted by power, and we can get arrogant. So we're thinking here about the bankers who are taking on the risky securities, and it's easy to see how that might happen, that people are willing to take on risky securities because they're proud of themselves, they think they've done very well recently, so why should anything happen to them in the immediate future? Dick Fuld at Lehman's, you may have heard about, was the very dominant boss of Lehman Brothers, and he was famous for not wanting to hear anything that was contrary to his own point of view. And that's another example of what I would call hubris and pride. And because he wasn't willing to do that, then he allowed his bank to ultimately get in the position where it was vulnerable to collapse. So hubris and pride is something that the Bible is warning us about there. And it's not something that we come up with in economics. It's nevertheless something that, if banks had been a little more aware of it, they might have known what they were getting into. A second aspect of the Genesis story of the fall is the breakdown of cooperation between human beings, that Adam and Eve, once they'd eaten the apple, suddenly started arguing with each other and saying, it's her fault, God, you put me with this stupid woman and she's given me this apple, is what Adam says. And which doesn't really get him very far, because he ate the apple. He didn't say anything about, he didn't stop anything happening. So breakdown of cooperation, the sort of issue of loss of relationship, again, is something we can link to what's been happening in banks, that we've had competition rather than cooperation within firms. And that's partly been fostered by the bonus culture. If the bonus culture says that this trader is going to get a bonus if he does well and this trader is not going to get a bonus, then it's obvious that this trader sitting next to that trader will not share information, not wish to cooperate, but will rather seek to maximize his own gains. And that sort of thing is not in the interests of the bank, because the bank would be much better served if people cooperated rather than competing with each other. And then the third aspect, again, is the blame game after the disaster. As I said, the Adam and Eve started arguing with each other. And again, that's rational to do that, to seek to avoid responsibility for your actions. If we go back to the previous page, you'll remember that reputation is something that people try and keep in economics, because it's something valuable for the future. It may enable us to get a better job and earn some money. And one aspect of that may be to say, well, the best way to keep my reputation is to avoid taking responsibility for anything. But on the other hand, if no one's willing to take responsibility for anything, then it's much more likely that the whole system will run into a risky situation. If people are willing to take responsibility ex ante, then maybe the need for the blame game after the disaster will be avoided. So again, Genesis points to that issue, which we can also see in the banks. Quality of work. There's a wonderful passage in Ecclesiastes, and what it says is something like this. What does a man get for all the toil and strife that his work gives him during the day? even at night his mind doesn't rest. So what it's saying is that after we as mankind in the Bible separated ourselves from God, then the work, which was supposed to be something positive, supposed to be something that benefited us and was a pleasure, became something that was rather stressful and rather unpleasant. And if you think of work in the financial sector with its stresses, with the long hours, the fact that people never see their families, you can see that that sort of fallen aspect of work is definitely there. Maybe in the central bank things are not quite so bad, but even there there's an issue. And the fact that work for mankind can be so stressful can be an aspect of making errors, can be an aspect of leading to the problems that we have in the banking sector now. What we can add, though, is again, is that the Bible is very realistic about irrationality. The Bible is full of examples of people acting irrationally and not in their own interests. It talks about the people at the time of the prophet Isaiah worshipping blocks of wood. They would chop down a tree, and then half of the wood they would use to heat up their food, and the other half they would make into a god, and they would worship him and say, "You're my God," even though the other half of it they used to heat up their wood, their dinner. So irrationality is not absent from a biblical point of view, and lack of foresight, and therefore we shouldn't be so surprised, perhaps, as we are as economists, that human beings are irrational, and seek to understand that better. I've said that the quality of work after the fall became much more unpleasant. It talks about from now on you'll get your food by lots of difficult toil, thorn bushes, etc. That's what God says to Adam as he throws him out of the garden. But on the other hand, the Bible also does encourage hard work and vocation. It really celebrates skilled work. For example, the people making the tabernacle of the Israelites. It says that we should work with all our hearts, do the best we possibly can, those of us who are Christians, as if we're working for God and not for men, which is a passage I find very inspiring. That, you know, the Bible is still telling us that we should work for something and not necessarily just working for ourselves. We can work hard and we can be honest. We can put others' interests first, but we can still progress. There's nothing wrong with ambition, but there should nevertheless be an avoidance of the sort of purely selfish approach that that economics encourages us to do. And what sort of things can we think about in terms of hard work and vocation? We can think about the word diligence, for example. The Bible says the diligent man will do well in life. And the diligent banker is the one who assesses the risks correctly, the one who sees that the AAA CDOs are not really the value that they should be. The integrity is something that that should be more encouraged, in my view, in the financial sector. There are lots of texts also that we can relate. We've talked about business ethics so far, which relate to banking. For example, the need for diversification. In Ecclesiastes, again, it talks about casting your bread on the water. It's like diversification. And of course, the banks miss that in their rush to invest in CDOs. It also says weights and measures should be accurate. In the ancient days, people would have short weights and measures so as to fool the poor people, in the same way the credit rating agencies, I'm afraid, had inaccurate weights and measures. Interest and usury is an interesting aspect. As you know, Islam is against any interest, and Christianity was against interest for most of its life. But I think the point of view I would adopt is one of John Calvin, the reformer, and he said, It's okay for people to borrow and lend to each other according to the law of love. In other words, that, you know, it was something mutually beneficial. But even Calvin would have condemned lending if it was for exploitative purposes. And I think it's not difficult to see that, say, subprime lending could certainly be exploitative. It could lead poor people to losing their houses. It could be misleading to them because they had a teaser rate at the start, which was then boosted so that suddenly they were unable to pay. And the initial idea, of course, was that the banks would seize the property, make a nice profit, and the person would be back on the street, maybe having lost their own money as well. So that's what the Bible calls usury. And the consumer protection aspect of regulation, I think, requires us to think perhaps a little harder about usury when credit can be exploitative of people's ignorance and exploitative of poor people. A few comments on what Jesus has said about finance. As I said earlier, he drove out the money changers from the temple, which sounds somewhat against finance. On the other hand, he told the, in the parable of the talents, he told people to put their money with the bankers, if anywhere. I wouldn't draw too many conclusions from that. But the one that interests me is what we call the parable of the shrewd manager. Parable of the shrewd manager talks about a servant who's told he's going to get fired, and he immediately uses his master's money to reduce the debts of those people who owe money to his master. And the master says, in an earthly way, you've been quite smart, but I don't think Jesus actually approves of what he's been doing. What the issue there is, how trustworthy are you? How trustworthy are you? The servant was not being trustworthy to his master. It was a classical principal agent problem. He was not given gardening leave when he left the bank. And so what did he do? He invested the portfolio in all sorts of things the bank wouldn't have liked. So, and trustworthiness, again, is a virtue that we don't necessarily take sufficient note of. And at the core of it is, who is your master? And Jesus says, in the end, you can't serve two masters. You can't serve money at the same time as you serve God. And that's an important trap that people can fall into, perhaps including the bankers in the financial sector. There are widespread warnings on the dangers of greed. A quote here, whoever loves money never has money enough. One always wants more if one gets fixated on money and has it at the core of one's life, as opposed to using it as a tool, but having at the core of one's life relationships with others and with God. And one of the best parables, I think, on that is the parable of the rich fool, who his industry was doing really well, high productivity. He built loads of barns in order to put all this grain in, and he thought, I'm going to have an easy life from now on. But the trouble was, he died that night. And in the end, what Jesus says is, if you're not rich towards God, then these things may happen to you. You'll have a useless life if you are overwhelmed with greed. There's a risk, I think, even for Christians, of compartmentalizing their lives, that they take too much note of, they're on Sunday they're very religious, but then on Monday they behave in a grabbing way in the bank, just like everyone else. And that's a warning for anyone, I think. And Babylon in Revelation 18 is an interesting further example. This, to my mind, if you reread it, is an example of a financial crisis. It's actually to do with the projected fall of Rome that was being prophesied, and actually did happen, of course, when Attila the Hun, whether it was accompanied by Estonians, I don't know, but Attila the Hun came to sack Rome in a few hundred years later. And what Revelation chapter 18 says, although it's to do with the fall of Rome, has a lot of echoes of a banking crisis, in the sense that it talks about merchants crying because no one's buying their cargoes anymore. It talks about people losing their jobs. And the judgment on Rome on Babylon, as it's called, they use the word Babylon as a sort of pseudonym, is that it exploited people. It was very ostentatious and it was very proud. And as I stand here in this lovely country, I think of your neighbour, in a sense, and how the same sort of fate overtook the Soviet Union. And finally, it's the challenge to seek integrity, I think, that the Bible is throwing at us. It's saying, and throwing at the bankers, it's saying, how come we don't act in a sort of consistent and honest manner? So you may say, well, these things are a bit distant from each other, all this ethical stuff. What can we possibly use in practical terms? And so that's what I try and address in what I call confrontation and reconciliation. And I think one thing that one might agree with between those two sort of approaches is the need to tighten regulation. That's fine, that errors have been made, risks have been excessive. But how far will regulation really solve the problem? How far will regulation solve the problem? And regulation is a bit like complete contracts. You try and tie people in contractual knots, but in the end, they always find ways around them. They find ways around Basel rules. They find ways around various internal bank behavioral rules. And the challenge is to think not just about rules, but about values and virtues. So what do I mean by values and virtues? Well, values are at least things that we can say are good, you know, like that the firm should act in a sensible manner, that they should be prudent approaches, that should, etc., etc. You can have many firms have value statements, don't they, in the modern economy. They have lists on the walls of things that you ought to do. But even values, I think, are not sufficient, because values are always something external to people. It's saying, well, here's how you ought to operate, but, you know, people move their desks so they can't quite see the list of values on the wall, and they're easily forgotten. In the end, what is really needed, in my opinion, is virtues. Virtues are things that are internal to people, leading them to act in a prudent, honest, etc. way. And an interesting example of that is looking at HSBC. HSBC, as you may know, is the bank that has suffered least in the UK from the banking crisis, in the sense that it has avoided most of the big difficulties that all the others have fallen into. And I'm not saying that this is a sole reason for it, but the chairman of HSBC is actually an Anglican minister, a guy called Stephen Green. And he may well have set the tone, at least, for the sorts of things that HSBC did that was virtuous. And if you read in the FT, I found a recent article by the head of Santander, and he said, what we need to hire in banks is people who are virtuous, not just people who are clever. We need people who have, if you like, internalized ethics. And obviously one source of virtues is Christian ethics. And that leads to the issue. Well, can you just insist on them? It's not an easy thing to make people virtuous. But in a sense, that's what the education system and should ideally be producing. Another thing that I think both the Bible and economics would agree with is retention of experience in financial institutions. We see the commercial property crisis going on every 18 years or so. And what's the issue? Usually the old guys have moved on or been fired because they're too expensive. Equally, there's a case in the Bible where the king of Israel chooses to listen to his young counselors rather than his old ones. And his young counselors give him really stupid advice, this guy called Rehoboam. And it ends up splitting the kingdom. So listening to the, keeping the experienced people is something that I think both the Bible and economics could agree with. And that's something that regulators might think about in the context of how banks operate. if we think of the fall of Babylon, but equally the sorts of comments that people like Mervyn King have been making recently, we can talk about whether the financial system has become too dominant in the economy, and that's a live debate in the UK. From an ethical perspective, a Christian perspective, one would argue that the financial sector has set a tone for the economy, and banks themselves have become proud and almost idols in the economy, and that's a bad situation for the whole economy. But equally, from an economics point of view, we can say that banks have been sucking talent out of the rest of the economy, and that's not in the long-term interests of where we are aiming to go. And finally, re-establishment of relationships in banking. The Bible says that rather than having money at the heart or our own interests at the heart, we should seek to have relationships with others and with God at the heart. And relationships within banking are, in the end, the way in which one avoids some of the problems that we've seen in the financial crisis. Why did the subprime loans prove so badly performing? Part of the reason was that the people who made the loans actually had no relationship with whoever was ultimately going to hold the loans. In banking, if you like, this is an argument for a return to simplicity. In Sweden, they said the banking crisis happened when the bankers ceased to lend to people they could see from the top of the church tower, right? The banking crisis started happening when they stopped lending to people they could see from the top of the church tower. In other words, when they stopped having loans to people who they actually knew about and who they could do something about if they were getting into difficulty. I mean, you know, this may sound like a pipe dream, but I think that in the end, if there aren't relationships, then the principal agent problems get worse and worse. And that was made the step from a bank taking a mortgage and holding it on its books to someone making a mortgage, giving it to someone else to securitize, to get held by someone else the other side of the world, has damaged the relationship that even a large bank could have with its clients. And in the UK, it's notable that Nationwide, which is the largest continuing mutual building society, has not had much of a difficulty because they have relationships with their clients and they keep a close eye on what they do. So that's just a flavour of this thing. Just briefly, what wider. Obviously, I don't have the underlying argumentation here. I suggest that there may be we may need to challenge the dominance of economics and its effect on our way of life. The assumption that the market system is rational and self-stabilizing. I think everyone is a bit more cautious about that. This is the point about values and virtues. But that may be difficult to encourage. Christians should be in the city, ideally. Obviously, this is addressed to Christians in the FSA. Banks need to retain experienced staff. The size may need to decline. Relationships. So those are the points I've just made. In terms of indebtedness, bank behaviour, regulation, but also restraint is needed. In the UK, we need to look at other countries where credit's less freely available. This is quite a radical one. House prices, in a sense, are an injustice to the next generation who don't have them. So should taxes be imposed which would reduce them relative to income? Not going to be very popular. Consumer credit can be very destructive. Is responsibility actually taken for it? One possibility is that you impose a nationwide limit on the interest rate of consumer credit, which would, of course, reduce the amount of credit available because banks would worry about risk, but they would take much more responsibility in that case. Ensure assessing whether it can be a reduction in the existing household debt. I do doubt whether that's possible, but whether non-credit forms of housing finance are feasible. Islamic mortgages, for example, are quite interesting in that they don't involve interest, although whether they actually reduce risk for households is not so clear. But the church can be a provider for an alternative culture to debt and consumerism. It really annoys me that in the UK, students are already inculcated into debt by having a huge student debt, which didn't used to be the case. Maybe that's the same here. The burden of government debt is something to get concerned about, and the role of structural deficits, that the government have misled the population, that the government needed to warn about the credit and housing boom. It seems to me that they could have looked back and said, the situation looks like 1989-90, and we know what happened after that in the UK. Seeking to see to what degree the tax system promotes indebtedness, like the corporate exemption of tax for debt, is worth thinking about, and whether we treat the government as something that's idolatrous, sufficient, rather than the responsibility of ourselves, and similarly with the bankers. And finally, greed, selfishness, and impatience that have been exhibited across many aspects of the crisis. So that's suitably controversial. I don't know if you've got any comments or thoughts.
I wonder what people are actually rationing. Just they like spillovers.
Okay? Yeah.
If somebody makes a decision which seems to be irrational because it doesn't maximize that person's utility directly, maybe this person gets this utility from something else. For example, giving money to the poor or something else.
You could say that.
Then there are less poor people or somehow this person gives better, and this is...
That's what they call the warm glow of charitable giving. In a sense, I'm not denying that the world is fallen, in a sense, that we are selfish. So in that sense, economics is a first-pass approximation to the way people behave. I think I would agree with that, because, you know, it says we're selfish, maximizing, etc. And to some extent, that's true. But I guess I'm saying two things. One is that we may act irrationally in the pursuit of those things. But the other one is maybe there's a better way as well that is not impossible. Anyone else? Or is that a good way to finish?
It's a good way to finish.